Kaf Kiddushin. So let's start from about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 lines from the bottom. Amar Shmuel by Yitzchak. Lo shanu elo mitakanat azav ha'elech. It should be on the material that I handed out. On page 2.
Oh, no.
It's on the second page of this handout from the computer, but if you prefer to see it in the printed, if you're still old-fashioned and think that you have to see a Gemara printed rather than on CD-ROM, then...
Yeah, P16th
century. Amar Rav Shmuel by Yitzchak Lo Shanu Elo Mitakanat Ezra Ve'ela She'ein Batei Dinim Kruim Elo B'Sheni B'Chamishi. That this rule that the marriage should take place Wednesday afternoon, Wednesday evening, is only from the time of Ezra's Takana, that the courts sit on Mondays and Thursdays. Okay. I will call them Takana Ezra, but before Ezra's Takana, Shebatei Dinim Kvulim B'chol Yom, when they had the Bet Din meeting every day, Isha Niseit B'chol Yom. Then the law is that a woman can get married any day of the week. It wasn't necessarily limited to Wednesdays. So the Gemara asks, Kodim Takana Ezra, Mai Dahava Ava. Why is Shmuel telling us what the law is before Takana Ezra? I mean, that's a historical question which has no relevance. In fact, the whole shiur tonight will be on a historical question that has no relevance. But since the Gemara says we shouldn't consider these kinds of historical questions which have no relevance, so the Gemara says, "Ela hachi kama." This is what Shmuel meant to say. E ika vateidin in the kvuin haidna kakodem ezra takanat ezra. If you have in a major city, for example, where the courts are so busy that they have to sit every day of the week, but not just limited to sitting in a small town Mondays and Thursdays, Ishana Niseit B'chol Yom. Then a woman can get married any day of the week. There's no requirement that the woman actually be married on a Wednesday. Hova Inan Shaktu. But the Gemara says when the Chazal insisted that the wedding take place on Wednesday in order that he have 4 days of the week in which to prepare, as opposed to having it due on Sunday when he didn't have time to prepare. So the Gemara gives us an unclear answer, the Tarikle, that he actually did prepare. The husband, we're talking about a situation where maybe with the advent of refrigeration, it's conceivable to prepare the meal before Shabbos and even have the wedding on Sunday. Nothing terrible will happen. So that according to Shmuel's halacha, this whole Mishnah has in fact disappeared. That is, in a situation where you have a large town where the courts are sitting every day of the week, or in our situation here in Brookline where I don't think the courts sit any day of the week, the idea of the requirement of having the Ptulah Niseit B'Yom Revi'i is no longer relevant. In fact, there's a Tshuva of the Ramash, which I didn't Xerox for you, which I will read for you. Ot Sha'alta Yerushalmi Hu HaMchidushei HaRashba V'Ktuvot Hada Amwa Halein Dekansin Amulin Tzrichin L'Michnas B'Va'od Yom Shilo Yeh Kekone Kinyon B'Shabbos. That a person who marries a widow and the wedding is taking place on this large handout today, the wedding is taking place on a Friday afternoon, it should be sure that the wedding is finished before Shabbat, so it should not appear as if a business contract has taken place before Shabbat. My hefresh, she asks, bein betulah almana le'inyan kinyat kinyan b'Shabbat. If the rule is that you shouldn't have something appear like a contract taking place on Shabbat, what difference does it make whether it's a virgin or a widow who is being married? Tshuva, ibra. There's certainly no difference as far as these laws are concerned. In the time of the Gemara, a betulah was not married on a Friday. When our Gemara that we just learned that once the courts are meeting every day, then the woman can get married every day, that excludes Be'yahu ha'mafal shimzal chutz mi'erev Shabbat, except Friday, because the court certainly did not meet on Shabbat. Lefi she'ein beidin yoshin b'Shabbat. V'ika mishum ikurei da'ata. So therefore, when the Rav Ash is first saying that when the Gemara here said that nowadays that the courts meet every day, the women, a tula can be married every day, it meant every day except Friday. V'sha'alu anin hagenu lamak tulet nesa be'erev Shabbat. But now our custom here in Spain is that all weddings took place on Friday. So why, if Friday was excluded from this law, why is our custom to have weddings on Friday? V'teotzu lefi she'ein anu miyachdim al erev shishiv shiva yimei hamishteh. Apparently they didn't actually consummate the marriage. I don't know anything about this custom until a week after the actual wedding. V'od, here's the principal answer, shuvan mekadshin v'kontzin yachad. Most marriages nowadays, the Rav Ash is writing in the 14th century, most marriages nowadays have the kiddushin and the nisuin simultaneous. Of course, now, for us, all weddings now have the marriage, so therefore, v'lekel ameichash zintatachta. The whole issue here is whether there has been some adultery committed by the wife between the time of the Kiddushin and the time of the Nisuin. But if the Kiddushin and the Nisuin are taking place on the same ceremony, basically, then there's no shash.
Isn't there two meals?
What? We discussed that a couple of years ago when we studied that. But I just want to point out at least I wanted to do one halacha today. Okay, because the main subject of today is an entirely different one. Okay, my shaftu, what is this business, the question and answer having to do with the fact that Chazal were worried about the young women? If they ma amru tula nisek li yom uvi'i, שאם היה לו טענת בתולים ומשכים לבית דין ותנעשה ביחד בשבת, ואם היה לו טענת בתולים היה משכים לבית דין, שקדו חכמים על תקנות בני ישראל, שיהי אדם תורח וסעודה שלושה ימים, אחד בשבת, בשני בשבת, בשלישי בשבת, ורביעי קונסה. So that's just a repeat of what we studied on the first time. And now here's the main subject of tonight's shiur. It's an unusual nature of the shiur. מסכנה ואילך, from the time of the danger forward, nahagu ha'am liknos b'shilishi v'lo michub yadam chachamim. From the time of the danger, so this is referring to some oppression, presumably some Roman oppression, that's the usual phrase of sakana, meaning either the time of the Kafka revolution or earlier the time of the revolution and the Korban Havayit. But whatever, the word sakana normally means, is referring to Roman oppression. Umi sakana ve'elech nahagu ha'am lechnos b'shlishi v'lo michu b'yadam chachamim. U'v'sheni lo yichnos v'im ma'amat ha'ones muta u'mafrishim et ha'chatan min ha'kala l'elei shabat kilom ha'pnei sh'osef chavura. Okay, we'll discuss that issue later. My sakana, what is this reference here to a sakana? I leima da'amui b'tula ha'niseit liyom ha'revi'i te'harei. If the issue was that all weddings that took place on a Wednesday, the people would be killed, nahagu lagamri miyakve. Let them just completely eliminate this law. What does this mean, nahagu? Amar Rava, the amri, but this is not what the ones was. The amri betula hanisei biyom rivi'i tiba'e lehegamon tchila. That a girl, a bride who was married on a Wednesday, would first be raped by the hegemon, by the ruler. Okay. Hai sakana. Why do you call this sakana? Onesu. This is rape. It's not sakana, but it should be called ones, not sakana. Mishum de ikat snuo de maslu nafshayu laktala. There are some girls who would prefer to die than to undergo this. The atyam l'day sakana. The lidrish l'hu the ones shari. Let them be taught that they don't have to give up their lives or to salvage their honor under such a situation. Ika putzot. There are some, if you said that, then you would open the door in the other direction. Ika nami kohanot. V'li'akve. If that's the case, why didn't they in fact revoke this gzera? So the Gemara says, gzera avida de batla v'takanta de rabbanan mikami gzera lo akli. This is a famous quote that we saw last week that the Chatam Sofer made on the issue of not changing, making changes in the marriage. Okay, so that's our Gemara. Our Gemara states that there was some period of time in which there was a Roman oppression which was of the character that the bride on her wedding night was taken by the hegemon.
What character would have had with a day of the week?
Well, if the Gemara says, the Gemara asks this. Ilhaki b'shlishinami. If that's the case, if you had a wedding on Tuesday, also the same problem. That was your question, Rav Yisro. So the Gemara answers me, Sveka lo akal nafshe. If the weddings weren't fixed at a particular day of the week, he wouldn't take the trouble to come into town to seize the bride. Only a regularly scheduled day. All right. The problem is with this story. The story of the hegemon. Because we found in our sources, we find this same story repeated in two or three completely different contexts. Here, the Gemara is referring to a form of Roman oppression. Okay? On the other hand, we're coming up to Hanukkah, and you all know that the Gemara in Shabbos says that the women are also part of the mitzvah of Hanukkah, Sha'af Hein Hayubi Otil Hanes. And on this passage in Gemara in Shabbos, Rashi writes, I've quoted it here, Hayuba Otil Hanes, Shagazru Yevanim al kol v'tulot ha'nesuot li'ba'el ha'tapsar t'chila, v'al yidei gisha nasa hanes. So that Rashi says that the story about having to be raped by the hegemon t'chila was not something that's referring to a Roman oppression, but it's referring to one of the causes for the Maccabean revolt. We'll see that in a minute. Okay. We have a third place where this same story is mentioned. In Yerushalmi Ketubot, again, seemingly having nothing to do with this type of oppression at all. Ha'ochel Esel Chamach, Barishona Gazlut Shmad Yehuda. They originally declared an oppression in Yehuda. This is again presumably referring to the Romans. Shekein Masorat Lahem Yevotam Sheyehuda Haraget Esav. That since Yehuda killed Esav, and since Esav stands for the Romans, according to this Medrash, and therefore the Romans were going to take revenge on Sheyehuda. Dichtiv Yadcha Ba'orecha Yvecha. V'ayu Holchim U'mishabdim Bahem. The onsinip notehen, and they would rape the girls. Because who shiyehe estratius boel tchila, that the estratius, which presumably is not the same thing as the hegemon or the tafsar, estratius is presumably a captain as opposed to a the hegemon. So hitkinu shiyehe ba'ala boel la uda b'beit avia. So here the Yerushalmi is using this story, again, of somebody being Bo'el Tchila, as an explanation as to why in Judah the husband, the bride and the groom would engage in sexual relations while they were still in the father, while the daughter was still in the father's house. Normally the intimate relations between husband and wife would only start after the man brought the bride home, and here in this tale, the Gemara gives as a reason why they started intimate relations before the bride came into the groom's house was that she should be accustomed to having intimate relations with her husband, and this would discourage rape on the part of the captain, and
it's also the
What?
Yehuda.
Yes, but they don't give this explanation. So far we've had three different places in our texts which indicate this issue of somebody, the hegemon or the Asclepius, taking advantage of the bride prior to the husband. Okay? Let's go on. Gilat Ta'anit we have. B'shevasav they itnat l'vomoi miYehuda uYerushalayim. Remember that the Megillat Ta'anit is an ancient document. The Megillat Ta'anit is something that was a scroll of days on which it was forbidden to fast. And this probably was written at exactly the time of the Korban HaBayit, or slightly before, or slightly after. So it's one of our oldest actual written documents before the time of the Mishnah, before the time of the Gemara, and so on. This is Megillat Ta'anit, having nothing to do with Masechet Ta'anit. However, in addition to the original text, there was a scholium, that is a commentary on this text, that was written much, much later, maybe as late as the 8th or the 9th century, as far as we can tell. Okay? So all that the text of the original Megillat Ta'anit said was, you have it, the Shiva Asar Bey, it natlu Romoy Yehuda Yerushalayim, that on the 7th day of Elul, the Romans were driven out of Judah and Jerusalem. So this was apparently referring, I would guess, to some victory of the Jews over the Romans at some stage in the battle, at some battle in a war which they ultimately lost. Okay. However, the scholium, which is here printed in the name Gemara, which is a commentary on the original Megillat Ta'anit, says, "Mepnei shehayu matzirin lebnei Yerushalayim, v'lo hayu yicholim latzeit v'lavol mepneihem b'yom ela b'layla." Okay. All right, that would be fine. But now the scholium seems to again be referring not to the Romans; it switches gears into a reference to the Greeks. Uvameh hayu matzirim lahem malchei Yavan, hayu moshivin kasvoyot bayarot liumanin et hakalot. They would put questars, that's a Roman term, right? The head of the Roman legion in the large towns. So I guess this is perhaps higher than a captain, but it's not quite at the level of the hegemon. Lihiyot ma'anin et hakalot, to rake the brides. V'achar kach hayu nosot lebaleihem. U'manu et Yisrael shelo l'msmoach im neshotehem. So this was a form of, again, first night rites to the leader, but it's okay. L'kayem ha'shenemah yisha teyareis v'isha acher yisha glenah, or yisha glenah. V'lo yiha adam avakesh lisa yisha m'pnei ha'kastruyot, chazru machnisen oto b'chashai, shenemah v'ayvarech mehem kol sason v'kol simcha, kol chatan v'kol kala, kol v'chayim v'yoneh. That all weddings would take place in secret to avoid this terrible form of oppression. When her time came to be married, the questar came to rape her, and then that was the start of a victory of the Jews over the Greeks. So now this is not referring at all to an event with the Romans, but an event with the Greeks, and they were killed. Okay. And that presumably is Rashi's source for
the
Greeks were killed. So even though the Megillat Ta'anit seems to refer to the Romans, this interpretation seems to go back and refer to the Greeks.
Isn't there a reference to this in the Piyut for the Yom and the Rem also?
I don't remember. Okay.
Somebody's to feel of it.
If we now take a look at also a late Medrash, which I printed out on the next page, Medrash LaChanukah, since Hanukkah is coming, this is close up, this is relevant. We turn to page 2 of this Medrash here, around a halfway down. Amdu v'gazu aleihem gezerah mara. Shelo tikanes laila rishon ela etzel ha-hegemon shebamakom. That when a bride was to be married, that the first rights to her were the local hegemon. כיוון ששמעו ישראל רפו ידיהם ותשש כוחם ונמאו מלערוס והיו בנות ישראל בוגרות ומסכינות כשהן בתולות ונקיים עליהם בתולה הנוגעות ואימאו והיו יוונים מפתלמים בבתולות ישראל ונהגו כדבר זה 3 שנים ו8 שנים עד שבו מעשה אל של בת מתתיהו כהן גדול ונישאת לבן החשמונאי ואלעזר השמואל כיוון שיגיע היום שמחתה השיבוע בפריום וכשהגיע הזמן סעודה נתקבצו כל גדולי ישראל לכבוד מתתיהו והחשמונאי שלא היו ביותו הדור גדול מהם וכשישבו לסעול עמדה הכנה בת מתתיהו מעל הפריום וספקה קפה הזו על זו וקרא פורפירה שלח ועמדה לפני כל עם ישראל כשהיא מגולה לפני אביה ואחיה וחותנה וכיוון שהוא אחיה כך נתביישו ונתנו פניהם בקרקע וקרו בידיהם ויעמדו על ההר להורגה אמר להם שמעוני אחי ודידי מה אם בשביל שאמרתי לפני צדיקים ערומה ולא שום עבירה הרי אתם מתקנים ואין אתם מתקנים למסרני ביד הרי לתעלל בי לא יש לכם ללמוד משמעון ולוי אחי דינה צפר so In this story of the Medrash Hanukkah, we have a clear description of the events that Rashi was hinting at, namely that this bride stood up and embarrassed the entire assembled community into instigating the revolt. So that's the story that we have here. Okay, and we have one last reference to this type of an issue having nothing to do with any form of oppression. And that's in the Medrash Rabbah. ויראו בני האלוהים את בנות האדם וגומר רבי שמעון בן יוחאי קורא אותם בני דיינים רבי שמעון יוחאי מקלל לכל מי שקורא אותם בני אלוהים אמר רבי שמעון יוחאי כל פרצה שאינה מן הגדולים מן הפרצה ויוצא בשם בני הכמרים גונדים את האלים מה נשמע להם מצאת וספר רבי הונה בשם יוסף אמר כדי
Second paragraph.
Mm-hmm. You told him saying that. Ki tovot heina, amav yudan tovot katur nish kishahayu matibin ota leba'ala, haya gadol nechnas ubo'ala tchila. Zeo shekatur ki tovot heina, ela habtulot. So here you have a situation which seems to be indicating some form of oppression or some form of something taking place, when they would prepare the bride for the husband, the leaders would come in and take them first. Okay, this seemingly is something to do with the sins of the Bnei Ha Elohim and the Bnota Adam, having nothing to do with any particular form of oppression against the Jews. So here's the problem. We have the same story repeated in 4 or 5 completely different contexts, and how are we to deal with the issue of what this story means? The fact that there were times of oppression and rape, rape as a form of act of war, we unfortunately see even in this very year what's going on in Serbia, in Bosnia, and places like that. So there's no question in my mind that during the actual periods of war, there were forms of oppression given in the issue of rape. The question is whether this particular story, namely that they enacted a law saying that the hegemon, or the tafsar, as Rashi says it, is the one who would actually get first rights to the bride, whether this was an event that actually took place or did not take place. When you see the same story repeated in 4 different contexts, it makes you suspicious as to whether any one of them is referring to an actual event. Now,
I'm a little bit curious about them focusing so much on the bride. I mean, you know, the rapist really doesn't make much.
That's right.
The rapist really doesn't care.
That's right.
Whether the bride's a bride or
that's
the
right. So the issue here is exactly.
I don't know why the issue of a bride is so critical.
Right. Right. Okay. So what we have to do is investigate this whole issue of the first night of the bride. Before doing that, I want to quote two ancient sources on this. One on sexual harassment is brought together. I think the oldest recorded case of sexual harassment we find at the in the Epic of Gilgamesh, right? One of the complaints that the locals were making about Gilgamesh, I repeated this on this next page. Gilgamesh leaves not the sun to his father, day and night is the shepherd of Uruk. Is this the shepherd? Gilgamesh leaves not the maid to her mother, the warrior's daughter, the noble spouse. So here, the people were complaining to the gods against the form of sexual harassment that they were being subjected to by Gilgamesh, and as a result, the gods created Enkidu, and then there was that whole story of a friendship and a battle between Gilgamesh and Enkidu, and eventually leading to the whole flood story. So the idea that there might be oppression, here is generalized oppression, not only not just brides, but not necessarily just women. It seems to be sexual harassment of both sexes was the complaint of the people against Gilgamesh. On the issue of the first night, we also find another very, very ancient source. And this is from Book 4 of Herodotus. Now concerning the lands inhabited by the Libyans, the Andrimarchae are the people that dwell nearest to Egypt. They follow Egyptian usages for the most part, but wear a dress like that of other Libyans. Their women wear bronze torques on both legs. Their hair is long, and they catch each her own lice, and then bite and throw them away. They are the only Libyans that do this, and that show the king all virgins that are to be wedded. The king takes the virginity of whichever of those that pleases him. So here is a source, you know, what Herodotus is like 400 and something B.C., long, long, long before any of the time of the Midrashim or the Gemara for that matter, which indicates that this is a form of oppression in some foreign land known to Herodotus. Of course, there are lots of stories that Herodotus tells us concerning the geography and the behavior of various different peoples, and we certainly can't believe all of them. The reason that I mention this is that this particular issue, namely the form of oppression of the king or the feudal lord seizing the bride on the wedding night, was something that was a hot political issue in the 18th century. That is, the Voltaire, Beaumarchais, the Marriage of Figaro, for example, they were all using this as an indication of how oppressive the feudal system was and how the clergy were oppressing the normal people by this terrible seizing of the bride on the first night, which became to be known as the jus primae noctis, which is the more moderate Latin version. The actual name
clergy?
Of this...
You said clergy or what?
Both.
Clergy?
They were, according to Voltaire, this particular rite was being usurped by the local bishops as well as the local lords. So, and this became a big issue, sort of like Uncle Tom's Cabin was a major literary device leading to the abolition of slavery of this country in the 19th century. This issue of the droit de seigneur was regarded as a major contribution to the overthrow of the feudal system eventually and the French Revolution and all of those events that were taking place in Europe in the 18th century. In the 19th century, with the advent of the reaction against the French Revolution, there was a huge scholarly debate as to whether this right ever existed. In other words, whether there ever was any law which says that the local feudal lord gets first rights. And this dragged on, I think, throughout the 19th century. And some man named Schmidt, who wrote, not this Schmidt, but a different Schmidt in the 19th century, wrote a long book whose thrust was that there's no evidence whatsoever that this ever took place, and that this was a fiction of people's imagination. That was his claim. Okay. To give you an idea,
Holocaust denial.
Something denial. I mean, the question of, to give you an idea of this, I mean, let me read to you from two editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica of the 20th century. The first, the 1911 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica says, Jus primae noctes, or droit de seigneur, a custom alleged to have existed in medieval Europe, giving the overlord a right to the virginity of a vassal's daughters on their wedding night. For the existence of the custom in a legalized form, there is no trustworthy evidence. That some such abuse of power may have been occasionally exercised by brutal nobles in the lawless days of the early Middle Ages is only too likely. But the use, it seems, is a myth invented no earlier than the 16th or the 17th century. That's the 1911 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. The 1965 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica on the same subject says, a custom alleged to have existed in medieval Europe, giving the lord the right to sleep the first night with the bride of any one of his vassals. This custom is paralleled in various primitive societies. However, practically none of the evidence that we have deals with its actual enforcement in Europe, but only with the redemption dues that were paid under various significant names to avoid this enforcement. The question is violently controversial, and has been, especially in France, the subject of remarkable displays of embittered and scabrous learning. With some hesitation, it may be said that the weight of evidence does point to the existence of such a custom at a very early date in parts of France, and possibly also in a few centers in Italy and Germany, but certainly not elsewhere. So the 1965 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica comes to exactly the opposite conclusion of that the 1911 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, on the basis of no additional evidence, by the way. I mean, this is a difference of opinion.
They say it happened in France and Italy, but never in England.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, what... let's read the reaction in the Jewish press to the scholarly debate, in particular to this book by Schmidt, and then try to see if we can summarize the positions. Okay? So let's read. So I'm going to read two things, and let's just read. I'm just going to read through the articles with you. One by Isidore Weil, which was an actual book review that appeared in 1883. For this book by Schmidt, yes. And
thought Yaakov Katz was going to speak about it.
What do you mean?
He wasn't. There was some woman spoke tonight.
Last week. He spoke last week. You're a week behind.
Here's a book he writes of immense erudition. The list of works consulted by Mr. Schmidt, and which are presented at the head of at the top at the head of the book. Does it indicate?
Do we have that?
I'm just translating it to you from French. I'm reading it to you, just but I was, why should I read it in French? I might as well read it in English, right?
We did in French, I thought. I don't understand that.
Does it indicate in the least the thousands of authors, ancient and moderns, of all countries and of all languages, both unedited and unpublished? We will give an idea of this gigantic work and its conclusions as far as Jewish antiquity is concerned. One knows the lively debate which began on the 25th of March 1854 in the Academy of Sciences by his declaration that the Jus primae noctis had been actually
exercised in the Middle Ages by the lords and also by the bishops. Mr. Schmidt puts himself on the side of those who refuse to charge such a grave sin, such a monstrous sin, to the feudal regime. But if this pretended right of the seigneur had never existed in the Middle Ages, can't one find at least some traces of it in antiquity? The author, after having made a serious and minute examination of all the proofs invoked by the writers, comes to the conclusion that none of these proofs, all of these proofs, are based either on a excessive interpretation of the texts or on equivocal or misunderstood statements. Okay? One fact, nevertheless, seems to be contrary to the ideas of the author and give some support to the people that contradict it, and that is the fact that not only in both Talmuds, but also in different Midrashim, in the Tosefta, and the Megillat Ta'anit, and the Megillat Antiochus, and in various other Haggadic sources on the Feast of Hanukkah or about the Maccabeans, we find these issues. We read, for example, in the Jerusalem Talmud, and that was what we just read before, in the early days, a bad, terrible persecution took place in Judea. One subjugated the Judeans, and one raped their daughters, and one declared that the Stratius had the right of first usage. In order to avoid this outrage and its juridical consequences, it was instituted that the husband or the fiancé could have relations with his bride in the house of the father-in-law, and this usage maintained itself during the persecution until the persecution came to an end, etc., etc. In the Babylonian Talmud, in the same treatise, in Ketubot, it explains by a similar reason the elimination at a certain time of an ancient usage told by the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that a virgin marries on Wednesday and a widow on Thursday, and the Brita adds, but since the time of danger, the custom was introduced by the people to marry on Tuesday without the Chachamim having any objection. And what was this danger? Did one kill the women who married on Wednesday? No, says Rabbah, but the enemy had decided that the Tafsar, and this is a misquote, none of our texts doesn't say Tafsar, by the way, says hegemon. Rashi was the one that used the phrase Tafsar here, could exercise all the rights of the young daughters, etc.
Okay.
No, that's an old word, but it occurs in the Midrash, but it means, it has the same meaning as hegemon, etc. Okay, and then he quotes the cases that we read about Matityahu and all of those stories. Okay. So, and then let's skip to the next page. From all of this testimony, the Tusei Temonage, from all of this testimony, doesn't it appear that the Batur Senur had in fact been in force in antiquity? This is not the opinion of Dr. Schmidt. Rabbah, he says, talks about a period which is so far in the ancient past that he could not have had positive evidence on the point that he was referring to, and so on and so forth. And then Isidore Weil says, well, but since the Gemara and the Midrashim tell us that this event actually did happen, we must disagree with Schmidt and therefore conclude that the Gebat Senior actually existed at some time. Okay? After this, there appeared a very long article on the subject, which was so stupid that I couldn't bring myself to reproduce it. But I did reproduce the response to it by Israel Levy, which is now on this next page. And let me just briefly read through this. Hanukkah and the Jus Primus Noctis. The brilliant article by our colleague and scientist, Mr. Samuel Krauss, presents a question of scientific method for which it is important, once and for all, to explain. Mr. Krauss, in his chapter entitled Chanukah, the Woman's Feast, has has given us the pleasure to see all of the beauty of the system of historical construction, which Gretz seemed to have disclosed the secret. The value of this method, which proceeds by equations and combinations, we hope to expose to the light of criticism in the forthcoming chapter. Hanukkah, the feast of the women. We have first to question the legitimacy of this name, which is the invention of our author, because never has Hanukkah been so called in any of the texts, even in the most recent. To say that the women have a cause to celebrate the Feast of Lights of Hanukkah because they had profited, like the men, from the miracle that God took place in the favor of Israel, that's not to affirm that it was ever called a women's feast. But what we're going to wait on dealing with this particular question, which is less interesting than the proof that we want to question here. The thesis of our distinguished collaborator could be said as follows. One is almost in agreement that the text of the Talmud that mentions the feast makes reference to dangers which were to which the women were exposed and young Jewish girls were exposed during the Syrian domination, and which disappeared after the victory of the Maccabees. This fact, Mr. Krauss adds, that one persecuted Jewish women under the Syrians is affirmed by many Midrashic works and several productions of later Jewish literature. Did this persecution actually take place, or was it something that was purely in the imagination of the storytellers? The most ancient documents and the ones most worthy of belief don't attribute to the Syrians any crime of this nature. Only the Romans, it seems, to have been guilty. And in effect, the Book of Judith, that is, which Heitzel Lachman Gretz quote the situation of the Jews after the war of Lucius Coetus, accused the Roman general of this particular crime. I didn't see it in the Book of Judith, but maybe he had a different edition of the Book of Judith than the one that I had, but I don't know. The Book of Judith, would this place it in the period of... He discusses here the question of what time it should go into, and so on and so forth. And then he quotes the passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, which talks about the Romans, tells us that during a certain persecution, the young girls were raped, and the young men were the young brides were condemned to be first taken to the striat. Thus, under the Romans, there was this persecution. And it therefore could not be a question. It could only be a question of whether it was during the rule of Trajan and Hadrian. In the Babylonian Talmud, the Roman functionary is called Tassa. This is again a misquote. I don't know why he repeats this misquote. I haven't seen it in any other edition of an oral printed text. We have Hadrian. Tassa was the name of the Roman governor in Syria, with whom the Rabban Gamliel. Had official relations, and he exercised his functions from about 80 to 117, and during this time there were various relations with a hegemon who was called perhaps Chietus, and therefore he goes, hey, just at any event, let me not read this to you through here, but his contention, and you've just followed his discussion from the beginning to the end, is that there is no real basis of any contemporary evidence from any source that this actually took place, and all of these are stories that...
What evidence could he be separated by?
Evidence from some document that occurred remotely close to the time. After all, the Mishnah was at the time.
Oh,
yes, but there's nothing mentioned of this in the Mishnah. And the earliest mention that we have of it in the Gemara is in the story of Rabba, which is a couple of hundred years later. And we saw it in the Medrash that was still later. Okay, what's happening here? Okay, so to summarize Levi's position, which I think is probably the correct one, is that we have this ancient story of the Yus Primae Noctis, and that it was obviously part of the general culture. And as Dr. Schwaber says, if we're talking about rape, it makes no sense to restrict it to any particular group of women. And that therefore, this was something that was absorbed into Jewish culture from outside sources. The issue is whether the outside sources are to be believed. Did this occur anywhere?
What would be more desirable, that the Ish gets raped or the Yosh gets raped?
Neither is desirable. The question is whether this is... The question is... Let me summarize what I want to say here. What we have here is an issue of whether a particular story